Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, welcome to the Only Still Show. Sorry, I didn't realize I was on right now. Tonight, we usually spend the night reading. And we spend every night reading, it seems. But tonight, I wanted to do a little self-promotion, I guess. I'm reminded of one of the great works of mind-expanding transcendentalism was came from Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he wrote his book Self-Reliance, and I've read that on the air. It's in our archives. On this Blog Talk Radio archives, and in that book or in that essay, he wrote about relying on oneself, believing in oneself, having a sense of self-esteem, I guess, self-worth, not depending on others to come up with ideas or not. You know, you always want to claim somebody else's work is good. You know, sometimes it's good. You take other people's word for it, even though you may not have read the book. Like, I've read hundreds of books on this show, and they've all been read by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe, or maybe not anybody, hardly anybody. But some of the amazing works that we've read here have been read by many, many, many people who are many hundreds and even thousands of years. And we're, but for some reason, people, everything is written. Everything good has been written. Everything bad has been written. It can't get any worse than this, or it can't get any better than that. And you know, so people don't even try to create something better, or answer questions for themselves. Instead, they go to a book or seek some other wise man or something for their own. What can I say, for their own satisfaction, their own gratification, you know, saying, oh, gee, well, you know, he's smarter than I am, so, you know, what I'm or whatever I write is nothing, but next to this guy or that guy, you know, he's brilliant, blah, 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 blah. Well, the only thing he had going for him, other than, you know, that more than you do, is that he probably had a good publicist. Or she had a good publicist, whoever that was. Or they themselves were good publicists of their own work. And so, you know, over time. So it's really not, somebody else usually creates your fame. You know, you don't create your own fame. You know, you like yourself, but other people create your fame, you know, whether, if they like your work. And how the hell are they going to know if they even like your work unless they hear your work or read your work? It's impossible. And how are they going to get to even know that your work exists unless you put it out there somehow, you know? And publishers aren't all that excited about putting everybody's work out there. So sometimes you got to do what you got to do, and you got to publish it yourself, or you got to, you know, you work with a publisher who can help you with it. And you know, and that happens, and that happened in my case, because the work that I do, for one thing, I don't like anybody controlling my work, you know, especially my creative work. I don't like it. I don't like being shut out of the creative process. You write the book, but then they format it, and then they throw it in, and then they throw a lousy-looking cover on top or whatever, and then just shove it out there for $10, you know. No, I mean, you know, that's not what I wanted to do. You know, if I'm going to write a book, I wanted to have process in creating the cover. I wanted to, you know, make sure I knew what the book was going to look like. Before it got published, I wanted to make sure that that everything was, you know, was right, and that, and, you know, so I wanted control. So, and the only way I could get that kind of control over my own work was to publish it myself. So I've done that, but I used a pretty good publisher who was, you know, into Amazon and into Barnes & Noble and into many other independent bookstores, and, well, not independent, but national chains and so on and so forth, and iUniverse.com is their website. But the fascinating thing about what I did was that I had this obsession, if you will, or this idea of compiling all my essays that are on my website, thelastoolshow.org, over the last now 6 or 7 years that I've had it, and I needed to write about the wrongs that I felt and the things that happened, and to establish some kind of credibility with this program as to how long we've been on, and the kind of fights we've been through, and the kind of problems that have arisen and over the last many years, but more so the kind of news coverage we've been able to put out there, and the kind of programming, and it seems to be a timely thing for us, because it's time that people had straight news and, you know, straight commentary, and, you know, it's time that in politics, but also in the sciences and the arts, and definitely in metaphysics, so people can be aware of the expanding consciousness of this time frame, of this time period. Human consciousness is expanded to such great degrees that it's now separating from itself, and we are as we evolve into a fourth dimensional consciousness. So, I want to get started tonight by reading from my book, and I'm going to read. I've done a number of readings on this book, but I wanted to read tonight chapter 16, and then lead into some of my metaphysical essays. I don't think I've read them, or too many of them on the air, but I know that I haven't read chapter 16 on the air. Pretty sure of that. I'm not sure. Well, I begin right at the beginning here is chapter 16, which is entitled Politics and Metaphysics. Since I began the L.A. Steel Show television program in 1999, I have been compelled to bring forward an inner voice that has been vocally restricted my entire life. It was a persistent nuisance in my day-to-day life that kept insisting that I release it. I had to write, I had to create songs, I had to paint and draw and create visual expressions. I had to voice my swelling anger at politicians or social injustices or whatever it was that violated some inner sense of right or wrong. Perhaps it was in my search for balance and symmetry in my personal life. Whatever it was that provoked my inner voice to speak out in the past persisted even more aggressively, so that by 1999, after seeking many avenues for self-expression, I decided it was time to break out and broadcast my inner voice. I had no previous broadcasting experience, but had years of training as a public speaker, and had written millions of words of unpublished writing in the journals, novels, poetry, and lectures. My 20-year career as a real estate and mortgage broker and real estate investor had certain elements that allowed me to establish a comfortable life for many years. However, I constantly felt unsatisfied both professionally and personally. I was at odds with many friends, clients, and business associates regarding political and moral beliefs. So few of, if any of them, had the curiosity or intensity I had for these areas of understanding, and discussing them at any length with most people was a complete exercise in futility. Throughout my professional career as a financial and real estate broker, I realized at the start that 80% of what I did was teaching people how to make a well-informed decision on the most important purchase of their lives. I had to teach them how to understand the true value of certain properties they wanted to invest in, and teach them how to choose the proper vehicles for financing their real estate investment. Throughout my real estate and finance career, I was constantly amazed by the absolute ignorance of the majority of real estate agents regarding the basic essential knowledge required for a career in selling real estate. I was constantly training agents to understand how to qualify customers and properties, so not to waste time and money escorting unqualified buyers or wasting time and money listing property that would never sell. It is this type of stupidity by the real estate industry that caused the trouble in the industry is in at the present. It took me 20 years of working in the real estate industry before I realized that the true driving forces behind the industry were greed and stupidity, and I wanted no part of either. The reader may wonder why I began this last chapter discussing the real estate and finance industries. I did so to prove a point regarding two vital industries that are married to each other. It is virtually impossible to sell real estate without financing it. Politics and metaphysics are equally married together. However, the metaphysical face of politics has been veiled from public view for reasons I wish to reveal in this final chapter. Few good political speeches are ever made without the invocation of a feel-good spiritual message relating to virtue, ethics, God, dignity, social evils, compassion, hope, national pride or brotherhood, and unity consciousness. These topics all relate to an invisible force of nature or divine intervention that signifies the good or evil in man by the assumption that there exists a divine providence that governs the universe. George Washington mentions this in his first inaugural address. All politicians use honesty and integrity in their campaign slogans. A politician's connection to a religion or some virtuous principle is paramount to their success in receiving a positive tone in their campaign and ultimately winning the election. The most common disappointment to voters who suppose support them is when they find out their elected official is really a scoundrel and the worst kind of hypocrite. Metaphysics is the study of the spiritual aspects of human existence. It is the mystery of faith, hope, and miracles. It is the foundation of all religions. It is the essence of community and family. It is love, charity, hope, happiness, sorrow, inspiration, genius, everything that mankind cannot empirically explain but knows exists. Everyone knows that there is a source of good and evil in the world, or in the universe, just as they know there is life and death. Between these polarities is the ground humanity must live on. The ground is the planet Earth. Human history has archives documenting 10 millenniums of human existence. Governments, religions, heroes, legends, and the rise and fall of great civilizations are all testament to the physical and metaphysical realms humanity has existed in. The greatest tales of history revolve around the conflicts of God and man, The divine aspirations of mankind are what creates its rises and falls. Divinity is a metaphysical term that creates God-like attributes to people and places that are beyond the explanations of science and empirical reasoning. There are countless examples of men and women claiming their divinity on earth. Divine right was the accepted understanding and rule of, and gave royalty its past and present status as rulers of nations. Emperors and empresses declared themselves divine, though no one could prove that they were. The royal elite were always granted their divine status by priesthoods, who were the keepers of the divine essence on earth. Their power was given to them and sanctified by themselves and the leaders of their religions. King Henry VIII of England was not the first, but perhaps the most well-known ruler to usurp the authority of the priesthood and establish himself as the head of his newfound Church of England. By doing this, he was able to divorce his Catholic wife and create a precedent that is used to this day to coronate a royal head of England. King Henry VIII dispensed with the holy business of using God proxies to bestow political power to a king. He fully understood the hypocrisy of divine right. Might makes right in establishing governments and religions. Without the strength of militaries and money, no one can gain or maintain power, and no country or ruler can build an empire without the support of its people. Politics had to marry metaphysics in order to control the masses. Politicians had to harness the spiritual essence of humanity in order to motivate. The emotions and intellect of people they were to govern. Machiavelli, who wrote The Prince, exposed the blueprint of acquiring and maintaining political power. These techniques have varied slightly throughout history. All men, women, and children understand the basic polarity of their own existence. The forces of good and evil plague us throughout our lives. The rationalizing of these metaphysical elements is what creates our mental and physical well-being. The moral decisions we must make in our daily lives keep us in or out of trouble and conflict with all of our fellow inhabitants on earth. Politics are ruled by the good or evil motivations of politicians, and politicians are granted their power by those who allow them to have it. A nation of immoral people will elect immoral leaders, and immoral leaders will rule immorally. A nation of people, of moral people, will elect moral leaders, who in turn will rule morally. It is simply A equals B equals C formula that anyone can understand. Cause, effect, and result is the fundamental principle that governs the universe, and this principle applies on both the physical and spiritual plane. I have devoted much of my life to metaphysical studies. My interest has led me to many remarkable people and discoveries. I often discuss metaphysical topics on my radio programs, and I wish to acknowledge two of my friends and teachers who I have had as guests on my radio show many times. My good friend George Dixon has been a noted researcher and lecturer in esoteric knowledge for 30 years. His research ranges in depth from the 12 secret schools. His research is extensive in extraterrestrial discoveries, archaeological and scientific evidences of alien visitations and abductions have brought an understanding of remarkable mysteries to me and to my audience. George Dixon is a regular weekly guest on the L.A. Steel Show every Friday night on my internet radio program, lasteelshow.org, between 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard. Every Friday night. And our weekly discussions have attracted thousands of listeners from around the world. The Friday Night with George Dixon series, soon to be available on CD, covers more than 51-hour programs which discuss the Mayan calendar, polar shift, 2012, ascension consciousness, sacred geometry, Egyptology, Montauk Project, Sumerian tablets, the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, the crystal skulls, the underground civilizations, time travel, multidimensional realities, Melchizedek, the Merkaba, and much more. It is my great privilege and honor to have George Dixon as a friend and a teacher. I made the most unique friendship of my life when I was introduced to Maria Fix Algeri by another good friend, Bill Marshall. Maria is a nationally renowned psychic who has the remarkable ability to communicate with spirits who have passed over from the third dimension. I, as well as thousands of people who know Maria and have been counseled or taught by her, will attest to her remarkable gift. Maria has been a grief counsel for many years and counseled families of the 9/11 World Trade Center disaster. Maria has shared great knowledge with me as a gatekeeper to the spirit world. She has taught me to read the tarot and to understand the depth of my own intuitive power. She has shared her remarkable insight with me and introduced me to the Agni Yoga. She has explained the mysteries of death and illuminated my life with the understanding of the unknown. Maria has been a guest on my program many times and has explained some of the great mysteries of the universe to my listeners. I have devoted 2 nights per week on my internet show for the last 3 years to discuss metaphysical topics. I have read on air the entire Agni Yoga series, a series of books written by ascended masters, giving insight and wisdom of the infinite. I have devoted more than 50 programs as reading and commenting on the different books of this, in the series. In the different books in the series of the Agni Yoga. And I am eternally grateful to Maria for opening my mind and heart to the wonders of the spirit world. Your programs with Maria and the Agni Yoga readings, please visit my extensive radio archives at blogtalkradio.com/LASteelShow.org. The metaphysical or spiritual element gives meaning to politics. It gives it stature, it gives it passion and purpose. Without the spiritual aspects behind what our politicians do, there would be little interest in electing anyone to office. A machine can do the day-to-day work of a non-deciding, non-involved, non-spiritual, amoral bureaucrat. It is the compassion and committal, or compassion and commitment of a political figure that gives them substance and creates their charisma and the excitement around a political candidate. Successful politicians understand that what their constituents want. They understand they want a leader of moral character, a leader of courage and conviction, and they will not select anyone who does not at least pretend to have these metaphysical qualities in his public character. Lawmakers create law, and by doing so, they determine the spirit which the law is intended. Is the law compassionate, fair, punitive, or preventative? Is the law designed to save lives, save money, or preserve something for the welfare of the general public? These are all subjective and spiritual reasons for creating laws. Even the concept of law is a metaphysical concept created by politicians to impose or to protect individuals and individuals and institutions. The marriage of politics and metaphysics is the foundation of this book and the foundation of my work for the last 10 years. The need to speak truthfully, or rather the need to speak truth to power, led me to create the mediums for my voice and the voices of others to be heard. And that's chapter 16. And next we roll on to the essays and insights. These essays were written between 2004 and 2009, and I'm going to read from the metaphysical section of the book. I have about 20 essays here. I won't be reading 20, obviously, but I will be reading a few. Working out of here. They had a few picked out that I wanted to. I don't know if I've read these before on the air. I don't think I have. Some I might have. I don't know. It's all a blur to me. And after you do 500 programs, you, or 1,000 programs, they all kind of run into each other. And as much as my as I want to, I want to go back and listen to some of these programs. And it's an awesome task that I haven't been able to conquer yet. So if I, after writing this book and then rewriting and editing and so on, and bringing it down to a readable collection of works, I had to date each one as well, and I had to date that each one was published, because not only does it show, prove, not only, well, it gives the book an authenticity or an integrity that I felt that by putting the publishing date down across from the title, bold letters and proud bold letters, it was important for me to do that, because not only did it allow me to go back and revisit the historical time, the historical presence of that period, but it could prove, it could pinpoint a day or a time when these events were occurring, and when they were very, very important in our lives, and they're still important in our lives, but they've been glossed over. You know, I'm going to start with a short essay that this I wrote in August 31st, 2005. This is right at the day of Katrina hit New Orleans. And it was absolutely devastating, and you saw these incredible pictures of the flood, and these people, just thousands and thousands of people, just walking to nowhere, and walking across the bridge, you know, trying to get out of the Ninth Ward that was all flooded, and many were met with guns from the opposite side of that bridge, because they didn't want any more people in that area. They couldn't house them or contain them. They were afraid of riots and looting. But on August 31st, I was watching television, and was watching watching it happen. And this is self-explanatory. I was watching television today and saw an endless stream of refugees from the devastation of New Orleans walking over a remaining bridge. I couldn't understand where they were going. It seemed like they all had one destination in mind, as thousands of people walking toward somewhere. Never in my lifetime have I witnessed so many Americans in such desperation. Never have I felt the sadness, loss, and abandonment of so many people at one moment in time. The tsunami was horrible, but it was far away in a different country, a different culture, a different hemisphere. These Katrina refugees were Americans, people like myself. I suddenly realized I couldn't hide behind distance or culture or indifference anymore. Except for the geographical difference, they were me. People walking towards somewhere, something, but could never turn back or return home. I envisioned myself on that bridge to somewhere, rebuilding my dreams as I walk, rebuilding my resolve to survive, wondering if I would survive as I fought back my fears, hoping to find water, food, clothing, and shelter. Walking alone except for the poor and homeless walking next to me. And I no better off than they, plagued with mind-numbing memories of everything lost, hoping my prayers will reach God and that I am not forsaken. I empathize with those people that day and the horrors of that time. And that was absolutely horrible. But on a lighter side, on September 7th, 2005, I wrote, "Rap, rap, rapturing at my door." And I confess that I hate the Bush family. I mean, I do. I abhor their name. I abhor them. And in my book, you know, there's so much, you know, about this period of time, the year 2000 to 2009, under the Bush administration and the conservative control of media. It was an absolute nightmare. And that's what forced these works from me and created this book, you know, in the need to create this book and to get the word out as to what was really happening down there, or at least how I was feeling, but what was really going on. And I did a lot of soul searching that during this period of time, and to understand what was happening and to try to understand what was happening to our country. But I wrote this one on September 7th, 2005. Rap, rap, rapturing at my door. Yes, please, dear God, take all the Bush family to heaven in a twinkling of an eye. Take the blessed Bush administration straight to their just reward. God, if they are truly deserving of heaven, please leave me here. I do not wish to be the same in the same world as they. Any world, celestial or otherwise, with Bush and his minions in it, I beg of you, Lord, I plead with you, Lord, God did not send me there. May God take his chosen rapturers and leave the earth to the meek as Christ promised. May God take these horrid human specimens and turn them into instant dust, never again to harm the world. Take with them all the malevolent evangelists and pedophilic priests. Take the Pope and all of his Vatican cardinals, bishops, and devout Illuminati. Rapture them, great God of mercy and compassion, and leave the world to those who have been so harmed. God, grant peace and the earth to those who have not the wealth or health or opportunity to survive under the hatred and contempt of a world ruled by demons and led by G.W. Bush. Rapture G.W. et al. Into your deepest, darkest vaults for eternity. Take them into the hell fires of eternal damnation. Lead the wonderful world of your creation to the meek, the humble, the gentle, and the loving people who will steward the earth and return it to its state of Eden. Do G.W. and his minions realize that if the rapture does happen, it can only happen, according to the Bible, during the reign of the Antichrist? Is George saying to his belief in the immediate rapture that he is the Antichrist and his followers are demons here to bring about the end times? It is possible. It would make sense if one looks at G.W. in that light. Maybe he's right. Maybe we are in the end times. I mean, we would know if he were the Antichrist, wouldn't he? But what if he just thinks he's the Antichrist, and he really is just a fucking little pissant psychopath who stole the U.S. elections and whose daddy paid off or threatened the Supreme Court and Congress, who fucked over the American people, and G.W. now thinks he can fuck over the entire world. I don't think Mr. Bush is competent or intelligent enough to be an Antichrist, nor do I think anyone in his administration is competent enough to be working for a master planner like Satan. I mean, hell, would the ruler of the world, the big evil one, want to be known as the biggest fucking idiot in the world? I think the big bad guy deserves a little more credit than that. If I were Satan, I would want the world to fear me. I would want the world to do as I say and do it without question. Satan would be smart enough to embody someone who could demand respect and you would think had a little charisma. After all, we are talking about the Prince of Darkness himself. The last guy you would want to look like or talk like or act like is G.W. Bush. Sorry, G.W., you just don't fit the bill. You make a great comic Halloween mask, kind of chimpish looking, scrawny with big ears and a stupid grin. But you don't really scare anyone, and you're absolutely not, do not command anyone's respect. So give up the big act, go back to your brush farm in Crawford, and stay the hell out of government. Because if you don't, the American people will make certain you are raptured on the cross of world opinion, and that you are scourged by the contempt of the millions who hate you. And yes, O great deliverer of mass destruction, let the world witness your great rapture of anguish, pain, and ultimate humiliation, and hear your pathetic cries to your father, Daddy Bush, and your mother, Babs, that the world cures your name, or curses your name, and the name of Bush for eternity. Humanity must pray for the day of rapture that will take G.W. and all his born-again pals with him. I pray that God takes him very soon before he can do more harm to this world by his absolute stupidity. I learned this form of prayer by listening to one of America's favorite TV evangelists, Pat Robertson. That's right. Pat Robertson wished for the death of all of the judges on the Supreme Court. He was quite the prophet there. Now anyway, that's alive. So I hope you're enjoying these. I wrote them with all sincerity, and we all face a time in our lives when we have to. I mean, we seem to always face these public trials in America. They do in Europe, too. It seems to be the trial of the century, or the trial of the year, or the trial of the... But there's always a big trial, somewhere like the O.J. Simpson or something. That seems to rile up public opinions. And during the... In 2005, we had the good fortune, as a society, to have two very intensely moral life and death decisions made that became quite well known. excuse me, made the headlines for quite some time. One was the death of Stanley Tukey Williams, his execution out in California. And the other was the death of Terry Schiavo. And that was in March of 2005. And Tukey's death was in December of 2005. I'll begin with Tukey versus the Terminator. This is published December 15th, 2005. 5 years ago. Awesome. By 9:15 p.m. on this night of Stanley Tukey Williams' execution, I could no longer allow myself to watch or listen to the insipid and insidious debates that are dominating television news over Arnold Schwarzenegger's decision to grant clemency and stop the execution, or to let Stanley Tukey Williams die. The decision was predetermined 24 years before, when four brutal murders were committed. Tukey Williams was the founder of Los Angeles's most notorious street gang. Could he have possibly been innocent of these murders? Maybe. But what difference did it make to the guilt or innocence of one of the most feared men in the country? Would Jesse James or Billy the Kid have been acquitted for a murder they did not commit, with the jury fully aware of their notorious reputations? It is highly doubtful. If we consider the worth of a man or a woman's life upon their conviction of a brutal crime, how are their virtues weighed? Remove the weight of anger and hatred and desire for revenge and consider only clinical justice. Can a judge or jury be clinically objective once they are made aware of all facts and have listened to all arguments by the defense and the prosecution? I do not know. But let us assume that it can be done, and was done in the Tukey Williams trial. The ultimate verdict was the death sentence. He survived 24 more years in prison. This was clemency by the judicial system, granted to him despite his later conviction. Many convicted criminals have faced their executioners in far shorter time. I believe Tukey Williams may have purged his soul before he was executed. He refused his last meal and any spiritual counsel in his last hours. He was prepared for the final decision and might have even welcomed it as the final chapter from his 24-year isolation on death row. Would clemency to life in prison have made any difference to him by then? He had done all he could do to try and redeem himself, try to show his rehabilitation. But to the actor, now governor, who created the film roles of Conan the Barbarian and the Terminator, the word rehabilitation isn't pronounceable, much less a comprehensible concept. Could the families of the murder victims accept that the rehabilitation and lifelong imprisonment of a cold-blooded killer was worth the lives of their murdered family members? Stanley Tukey Williams' ultimate guilt or innocence will always remain a question for any who remember his case. Innocence or guilt is often confused and rationalized, and the story of Tukey Williams will be forgotten within the next 6 months. His memory will be associated with the gang he co-founded, and guilt will be associated with his final reputation. As for the state of California and its prison system, Stanley Tukey Williams will become a statistic, dehumanized and deleted from the prison population, no longer a burden to society. Those who mourn now for Tukey Williams do not mourn the man, yet of them, or rather few of them ever knew. They mourn the ideal that he represented to them. He may have inspired some in his words and attempted rehabilitation, but death is final for both Tukey Williams and his victims. Who mourns for the victims? If the spirit of the slain are satisfied, a universal justice has been served. The biblical story of Christ on the cross states that in his final hour, he blessed the convicted criminal who was crucified next to him. Though Christ had the power to save himself and man next to him, he did not. Perhaps God embraced the criminal as his soul passed on. Perhaps Christ was with him and gave him hope and for knowledge of the afterlife. Perhaps as Tukey Williams prepared himself for his death, he calmly accepted his fate as he accepted God. We will never know, but we can believe that all death is destined, and so is life after death. The argument over the death penalty, pro and con, I have discussed often on my radio program. My co-host Lila is a devout opponent to the death penalty, whereas I am ambivalent about its use. I can wholeheartedly support the death penalty for heinous crimes in which the offender either truthfully confesses to the crime or is found guilty on all counts with unquestionable proof and positive DNA results. The most critical of all areas argued in this area in this debate is the credibility and availability of such concrete evidence. My sole defense of the death penalty is related to this area. If all proof of the intent and commitment of the diabolical crime is rightfully submitted by the competent prosecutor to a competent defense attorney, and seen and understood by an unhampered, unprejudiced judge and jury, then a sentence of death by the jury decision should be carried out. In Stanley Tukey Williams' case, none of this solid evidence was admitted to his trial. No DNA, no eyewitness, nothing but circumstantial evidence and the testimony of an inmate informant. There may have been more evidence that convicted Tukey Williams. However, I am citing all that has been released to the public. Mr. Williams retained his plea of innocence to the crimes up to the moment of his death. Was justice served in his case? I do not know. All the evidence submitted in this defense during subsequent appeals could not overturn his original conviction, nor commute his sentence to life in prison. Statements made by the prosecutors stated that this case was solid and Mr. Williams' guilt of brutal murders of four innocent victims was proven beyond doubt to judges and juries and reviewed many times over 24 years, resulting in the same outcome. If I or anyone were a juror or judge in this case, we may have been obliged to vote the same way. One extenuating circumstance that would have obviously clouded Stanley Tukey Williams' trial would be his notorious reputation as the founder of a ruthless street gang. What was his vision and intent when he formed his gang? Were murders and brutal methods encouraged and employed by the gang members? And was the mimicking of their leaders and followers, or rather following their examples, encouraged? Was the gang formed for self-defense against the violence of other gangs against them? Or was it founded for the same reason most street gangs are founded for, the promotion of criminal and violent behavior? If Tukey Williams spent his years on death row, writing against gang life and gang activity, as considered by his supporters to be proof of his rehabilitation, then obviously his initial intention when he founded his gang were based on less than noble ideals that spawned the creation of well-entrenched violent street gang. I believe the system worked properly in the case of Stanley Tukey Williams. Whether justice was truly served or he was innocent as he claimed to his death will always remain a question. In this case, the accused was convicted of four horrific murders, and he accepted his own execution stoically. And he must have understood that his case had been processed exhaustively through the system, through the U.S. judicial system, for 24 years, and he was still found guilty. His crimes far outweighed any further reason for tolerance toward him by the people of California. They could no longer support or justify any further reason for Stanley Tukey Williams' existence. The truth of his guilt or innocence will remain a topic of debate. However, for most of the American people, this case will be soon forgotten. Tukey Williams has become a prison statistic, dehumanized to a deleted prison number and an empty San Quentin death row cell, soon to be filled by another occupant. So that is kind of my argument against Tukey Williams' death. I don't know. I wrote that on the night that he was executed. Right after seeing it on the news. My last essay tonight is called A Tear for Terry. And I wrote this on March 29th, 2005. This is when Terry Schiavo died, right about that time. I feel saddened by the Terry Schiavo story. In this entire public outcry from the right and left, Terri Schiavo is forced to die without dignity. She can obviously not live with dignity. Did she want to be the poster girl for euthanasia? Did she want the Republican epitome of corruption, Tom DeLay, coming to her defense to keep her in a feeding tube? Did she really want baby Bush to leave his vacation and Crawford to come to her aid? I don't think so. Opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one. I saw this on a t-shirt once and thought it was appropriate. I have as much knowledge into the Terri Schiavo case as most who have been interested in the story. But I have no right to intervene in the decision or even attempt to sway anyone toward one side or the other. This is an extremely personal decision placed upon the custodian of Terri Schiavo's life. I have asked my own conscience if I would want to be left alive in a vegetative state, dependent upon someone daily to wash me and empty a urine and colon bag 3 or 4 times a day and feed me with a feeding tube until the insurance company or Medicare, whoever and whatever, decided I wasn't worth keeping alive anymore. I had to say no. What possible purpose could there be for me to want to delay my inevitable death? I would want to end such a pathetic existence as quickly as possible. If I was dying from an incurable disease, with no possible way of expressing myself other than a few involuntary bodily functions, I would be most anxious to leave such a life, and I would be totally embarrassed and mortified at the thought of ever insisting that some assigned guardian would have to make the decision for me. Just the thought of possibly being under the guardianship of some sanctimonious, born-again moron insisting that my agony must be prolonged, or that I should die a painful death by starvation and thirst because it is God's way, or having the President and the entire U.S. Congress intervene in a decision to extend my wretched existence indefinitely is beyond my comprehension. I would wish for a quick death. I would wish for a painless death. I wish for immortality so I may never know death. But the last thing anyone in their right mind could wish for is a painful and prolonged death. No loving spouse or family member or merciful judge could ever condone such a death. The passion of Christ didn't mean that we have to all be scourged and crucified or suffer great pain at death. Those who have read the life of Christ know that he wanted his death to be as it was. I am not Christ, and as far as I can tell, no one else on earth is either. Not the dying Pope or the wealthiest evangelist, and definitely not, though many of his moronic followers want to believe he is, G.W. Bush. And the Terri Schiavo story is a sad and disdainful episode that has incensed the American consciousness. It has become a magnifying glass, clouded by a tear, upon the true collective soul of the American people. So, and that was a little quicker than I thought it would be. I got another short one. Some of these are longer than others, some are shorter. I got about 6 minutes. I think I'll read this one. I don't know if I've read this one before or not, but I kind of liked it. It inspired me. It's called Altering World Reality. I wrote this on May 20th, 2005, almost 5 years ago now, a little over 5 years ago. all seen or heard of some miracle or form of healing not considered possible by the medical or scientific communities. We have heard of people who can create masterful illusions and confound all senses. We have heard of shamans and medicine men or psychics or spiritualists who have communicated with the dead or healed the living by magical incantations. Mankind has always been susceptible to a hoax or a con. World governments and religions operate by their masterful illusions of godlike or militaristic supremacy. Their illusion is based on the false belief that those who follow them actually believe in the institutions and authority. Most follow this for the sake of convenience and expediency. The power of these institutions is given to them by the passive collective beliefs of the cynicism of their followers. All spiritual and political leaders are master manipulators, showmen, or illusionists. Many years ago, I read a book by a man with only one name, Neville. He wrote and lectured during the 1960s and 70s. His writings and lectures were based upon the power of the imagination and how it alters the physical reality and can change the world as it changed his life and that of his many students who used his technique of visualization. Neville's book was entitled The Promise. It took for one of its major themes, premises, the teaching of Christ, who said, "Knock and the door will open. Ask and you shall receive." While Neville states that all prophets were not people who saw the future, but they saw visions of how they would like the future to be. They gave their followers a vision to embrace and a lofty ideal to center their existence upon for an individual and a society to achieve. Neville's book cites examples after example of the students and himself creating first in their minds a complete vision of what or who they wanted to happen to become. Within days or weeks after using the technique of visualization, their physical lives were completely transformed by a miraculous healing, a sudden increase in great wealth, or a perfect relationship, friendship, or marriage. This process of visualization has been used and perfected by artists, athletes, and entrepreneurs for centuries. So many successful people have discovered that visualization of their goals was vital to their achievement of it. Visualization is the force and foundation of all the greatest achievements of mankind. If we can imagine it, we can have it. Many who are reading this article right now wonder if I have put these practices to use in my own life. The answer is yes. Have I had success in achieving my goals and transforming physical reality? Yes, yes, and yes. When I have applied the strict discipline needed to accomplish self-abandonment by my intense focus upon my desired vision, remarkable results occurred. I will admit that I have failed to achieve immediate results in some of my visions, but I continued my visualizations for several months until the goal was achieved. But as a toothless child cannot chew a large steak, so is the person that cannot fully visualize their great success. We can only achieve what we are able to fully conceive. And when we first visualize our desire, we encounter many self-doubts, and we must keep in mind the desires of others and that their imaginations or their imaginings of us may, if we do not recognize them, be interfering with our own vision of what we want to achieve and what they believe of ourselves, and what we believe, rather, of ourselves. If a person can successfully visualize his desire, could that desire be injurious to someone else or to you? Perhaps that other person wants your job, your wife, your family, your wealth, or your life. Unless you have your own powerful vision of what you want to create, then you are doomed to become part of someone else's vision. If we do not have a vision of ourselves as we want ourselves to be, then someone else will create us the way that they want us in their own vision. Remember that nature cannot tolerate a vacuum. discipline of autosuggestion, focus, and the wise use of imagination equate to the high art of visualization, which will transform one's desire into reality. The old adage of beware what you wish for, it might come true, was first stated by someone who understood the effects of visualization. We unconsciously create our own reality every day by the positive or negative thoughts we project. And the imagination can create war and conflict just as it can create peace and harmony. And if the majority of the consciousness of the people from all over the world could be directed to the vision of doom and gloom prophets, why can't their collective consciousness be revived by a new utopian vision where all men and women cooperate fully with each other to project a seamless reality where universal wisdom, peace, and love are the eternally indestructible walls that will protect and defend human civilization? It is all only a thought away for that vision to become reality, Gandhi said. You must become the change you wish to see in the world. And with those words, I'll end the show tonight. My readings were from my book, Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And you can pick this book up at the Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or iUniverse.com. Just go to Naked at the Mic, M-I-C. Naked at the Mic. Right? And there's a couple of chapter previews up there. So I hope you enjoy them. And if you happen to be in the area on Sunday, don't forget, please tune in to WQQQ.com on Saturday between 1 and 3, and we'll be having a 2-hour special tribute to the WQQQ radio show, radio station, and the L.A. Steel Show, and the Naked at the Mic book signing. Okay? So, come on, listen. Garrett, take a listen to us Saturday between 1 and 3 o'clock. So I want to thank you, and that's Eastern Standard Time as well. So thank you, and have a pleasant evening.